more. Maybe it's not nice. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass may have in the middle of it. Grass may have in the middle. We are grass may have.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness, we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to be covering primarily the coronavirus or COVID-19. During this broadcast this evening. But first, we're going to start off with an update. I found an update of all places out of Al Jazeera. So listen to this update, and you'll get just an overall broad update of the different nations and what they're suffering through. Listen to this now. Thank you.
The coronavirus pandemic is forcing countries around the world to take extreme measures affecting all aspects of life for billions of people. Here's a global snapshot of what's been happening. Let's begin in North America. The United States has declared a national emergency hours after a travel ban came into effect for most Europeans planning trips to the U.S. Canada has suspended its parliament, while Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has advised citizens against any foreign travel, and he himself is under quarantine after his wife tested positive for COVID-19. Let's go to Europe then, which has, according to the World Health Organization, become the new epicenter of the outbreak. In Spain, a state of emergency has taken effect, with the government announcing a number of new measures that will be imposed while people in Italy get accustomed to living daily life under lockdown and finding creative ways to survive self-quarantine. Looking at the impact in this part of the world, Iran has reported 97 further deaths in a day, bringing the death toll there to 611. The foreign ministry has welcomed the fact that a number of countries have provided them with much-needed financial aid and medical supplies. Across many cities in Iraq, a general curfew is now in effect. Lebanon now has new cases. The number of infected stands at 93. And as a preventative measure, Oman has closed all schools for the next month. Qatar has suspended visa on arrival from 15 countries. Now, it's a mixed picture in Asia, with a jump in cases in Indonesia and the Philippines. However, Chinese authorities are declaring the worst of the outbreak there appears to be over, reporting only 11 new infections on Friday. We have extensive coverage this hour to bring you the latest on this fast-moving global story. Zain Basravi is in Tehran on how the Iranian government's efforts are faring in its fight to slow the spread of the outbreak there. In the Americas, we have Teresa Bo in Buenos Aires on what Latin American countries are doing to contain the virus. Mike Hanna is in Washington, D.C. to see what the U.S. is planning now that the president has declared a national emergency. But we begin with Sonia Gallego in London with news of a dramatic increase in infections in Spain and a nationwide lockdown. So, Sonia, what does this lockdown mean for the average person in Spain?
Adrian, what it effectively means is that everyone has to be confined to their homes, with the only reason being allowed for them to venture out would be for them to either go to work or in cases of emergency. Of course, worth reminding that still places of such as grocery stores and pharmacies, like in Italy, will still remain open for people to be able to survive through the these periods of self-isolation that they are having to undertake now. And the whole purpose of this really is to try and stem some of the almost chaotically, almost disastrous scenes that we've seen in Italy, especially around Lombardy, the sort of ground zero point of the whole COVID-19 cases that we've seen there, with the drastic actions that Italy, Italian doctors and nurses have had to take, a sort of trying to take on a wartime triage to try and save as many people as possible who they think will be able to survive this, and sadly of allowing others to die who they believe will not be able to make it through the virus. So all in all, this has had an alarming effect on governments outside of Italy as well, looking very much at Italy and thinking, how can we try and stem the worst of this as possible? And it seems that most countries are agreeing that locking down as quickly as possible and a way to try and stem those really high numbers of coronavirus cases in Italy is perhaps the best way to go about it, even if they cannot avoid the deaths that have been taking place along the way, Adrian.
And bring us up to speed with what's happening there where you are, Sonia, in the UK.
Well, this is also a cause of concern here because, of course, the UK was the outlier in Europe. Rather than taking the similar approaches that, for example, that Spain is taking, that France is taking, with Emmanuel Macron announcing his measures in the past couple of days, the UK has taken a slightly lighter touch approach. With the intention of that, as in sort of not banning up until now mass gatherings, but basically trying to stem and push the flow of that. But that is changing now with the numbers rising. Another 10 deaths announced today, taking the total number of 21. The Prime Minister is now having to reevaluate with emergency measures to be announced next week.
Al Jazeera's Sonia Gallego reporting live there from London. Sonia, many thanks indeed. Let's bring in Al Jazeera's Zain Basravi, who's in Tehran. So, Zain, all religious gatherings have been suspended in the city of Qom. Tell us more about that.
Well, Adrian, what we're hearing is that earlier today in the afternoon, the Interior Ministry issued an edict, an order, possibly and most likely that was something that came from President Hassan Rouhani's office. And in that order, it said that in two very important religious sites in the holy city of Qom, where the outbreak of the coronavirus started, a mosque and a shrine, those have been ordered by government order to be shut down. Now, it has to be said that it remains open for now, and in the order, it made clear that they will close them soon. Now, for many Iranians, this will be something that is better late than never. But for many critics of the government's response, they'll say this is too little too late, that the damage has already been done. Qom was, of course, the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak. There was a lot of criticism against not shutting down that city, not quarantining that city, and letting it become a major vector point for the coronavirus, for COVID-19 to proliferate all across the country. We're also hearing an announcement from the Tehran government, from the municipality of the capital, and they have halted all construction and building work projects for at least the next 2 weeks. Now, many will see these as necessary steps ahead of what experts say will be the peak of the virus in the next 2 weeks, but many will also see this as half measures the government is taking after taking a great deal of criticism for not being able to come to grips with this virus. And the fact is that many people will point to the fact that Tehran is still not under isolation, it is still not under control. People continue to move freely, and the government, again today, President Hassan Rouhani's government addressing rumors that the capital would be quarantined by saying those rumors are untrue, and that is simply not the case. The capital city will not be shut down.
Many thanks indeed, Zain. Let's go live now to Argentina's capital, Buenos Aires. Al Jazeera's Therese Abou joins us to talk about the situation in Latin America. Colombia has closed its land border, Therese, with Venezuela. A lot of people rely on that crossing, a lot of Venezuelans. What are they going to do?
Well, nobody really knows yet. That is a lifeline for many Venezuelans who are crossing the border to Colombia to get many of the things they cannot find or simply cannot afford in their country, from food, medicines, diapers, among other things. So shutting down this border will have a very, very big impact on many of people's lives. The problem is that Venezuela confirmed 2 cases of coronavirus on Friday, but many suspect that it could be even higher because of the current situation, the humanitarian situation in Venezuela right now. Some doctors we have spoken to say that the government does not have enough tests to carry out and test those who have fallen ill. And that's why President Iván Duque has taken this precautionary measure to close this border. The impact that this could also have is that many of those who are in Venezuela will try to take alternative roads into Colombia to try and get those of the things they need. These are dangerous areas with the presence of guerrillas, with paramilitary groups, among other things. And it's also many of the people we have spoken to say that Venezuela is simply not ready to deal with a pandemic, basically because of the situation its healthcare system is right now. There's shortages of medicines, there's no hand sanitizer, no soap. 80% of the hospitals do not have running water. So the situation in the country could simply escalate. President Nicolás Maduro appeared on television showing people how to wear a mask, making the use of a mask in the metro in Caracas, for example, as mandatory. But he's also saying that the sanctions imposed by the United States is making it much more difficult for Venezuela to get the supplies it needs to fight the pandemic. The vice president of the country, Delcy Rodríguez, also said that Colombia's measures are being dramatic, are being irresponsible, because they're only shutting down the border with Venezuela, but they're not doing the same thing with Brazil or with Ecuador, that also have confirmed cases of coronavirus.
Teresa, many thanks indeed. Al Jazeera's Teresa Bo live in Buenos Aires. Let's now go to Washington. Mike Hanna is there for us. So, Mike, on Friday, the president brought in this state of emergency, a national state of emergency. What's been the reaction to that? Has anything actually changed?
Well, there has been, it appears, an increase in the recurrence of testing. Now, this has been a constant criticism of the Trump administration. They were very slow to roll out tests. They were very slow in terms of coordinating a national testing protocol. At times, they were testing in the region of 100 people a day, whereas other nations were testing up to 10,000. Now, figures released by a private enterprise, COVID Tracker, indicates that in the past 24 hours, for example, 20,000 people were tested, or actually, to put it more correctly, 20,000 tests were conducted, remembering that at least 2 tests are needed. So that's 10,000 people were tested, which is an increase in terms of what had been reported before. But here lies the problem. The CDC, the Center for Disease Control, is not publishing any data anymore. It has basically shut down its website with regard to recording testing. So it's left to private enterprise to find some kind of data. And data, of course, absolutely critical in terms of dealing with this ongoing crisis. So despite this $50 billion, despite the Trump administration's assurances that things are being done, you still have this issue with unclear data in terms of who is being tested, how many tests are being conducted, and critically, how many are being tested positive to give some kind of indication of the nature of the trajectory of the disease. Now, added to that, the House of Representatives has passed a sweeping bill. This aimed at alleviating the suffering, economic and social, of American citizens. Now, President Trump indicated late last night that he would sign off on this bill. It's now up to the Republicans in the Senate to endorse the bill, send it to the president. Now, this bill would have a major impact in terms of how people live in coping with this crisis, in terms of payment for unpaid leave, all these kind of issues that many citizens have been deeply bothered about. But all in all, it's still too early to say whether the measures, the state of emergency announced by President Trump, is having any immediate impact. That will take a little bit longer to gauge. But as I keep on saying, made all the more difficult by the fact that there is no central database in terms of recording how much testing is being done and what the results of those tests are.
The question here in this country has been, there's not been nearly enough testing. So some of the things that are being uncovered about this testing problem is This emergency group that was put together in the White House, okay? They opened up a lot of possibilities for private companies, corporations to come in and start participating. But some of the officials, some of the employees of those people didn't want them to expose themselves to possible virus victims in swabbing them and so forth. So even though that they had testing facilities, some of the personnel of these private companies were not really equipped to swab and so forth. Now, in Texas, just in San Antonio, they're opening up just yesterday on Friday, Friday the 13th, in fact, March the 13th, drive-through. That makes more sense, see, than anything else. Now, otherwise, we have these computer models. There's one in Ohio, and Governor DeWine just recently made a statement through some interviews with his head health doctor that was heading up this particular model, and she's saying that there's going to be a tremendous amount, hundreds of thousands of infected individuals in Ohio. Here's what they say in a recent interview.
Of community spread says that at least 1%, at the very least 1% of our population is carrying this virus in Ohio today. We have 11.7 million people, so the math is over 100,000. So that just gives you a sense of how this virus spreads and is spreading quickly.
Ohio's top health official there saying that there are likely more than 100,000 undiagnosed cases of the coronavirus in the state. The governor ordering all schools closed for a three-week period starting end of the day on Monday. He is also ordering a ban on mass gatherings of more than 100 people as officials work to curb the spread of this virus. Joining us now is Ohio's Governor Mike DeWine. Governor, good morning to you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
So what are you doing actively to stop the spread of this virus in your state?
You know, I've relied on experts. We have a panel of 14 doctors, as well as certainly Dr. Acton, who you just heard. We also reached out to other experts yesterday, and it was clear that we had to take this action in regard to our schools. As Dr. Acton indicated, you know, we project we have about 100,000 people at least who already are walking around with the coronavirus. And what the experts tell us is that this number will multiply, will double every 6 days. So if you just think about that, you can extrapolate that out. You know, we're into some tough times in Ohio, and it's very, very important for us to do everything we can to slow this down. And so closing the schools is a dramatic and drastic action. We know there are other consequences. But it's important for us to do this. And the whole goal is to try to spread this out. We know a lot of people in Ohio are going to be infected, but what we don't want to do is overrun our healthcare system. We got a great healthcare system in the United States and in Ohio, but they also have a pretty good one in Italy too, and we're seeing what problems that they're encountering in Italy. So we don't want that situation, and we've got to slow this thing down. And so that's why we took these dramatic steps. The other thing that, you know, we're really emphasizing now to people is there's only so much government can do. You have a responsibility to not only yourself, but to strangers. The way this thing spreads, do everything you can to stay away from people who are sick. If you're sick, stay home. If someone in your family is sick, we tell people, look, treat that as if you're sick. You need to stay home as well. And these are drastic actions, but we're in very difficult times.
What access do the residents of your state have to testing kits, Governor?
I'm sorry?
Testing kits.
I didn't hear the question.
This has been a crux of the problem for the administration.
Yeah.
And
we have
access to testing kits in Ohio.
Sure. We have about over 1,000 testing kits today at the Department of Health, but we also have private labs that have this capability. Now our some of our major hospitals are coming online, basically, in regard to having testing kits. So you're going to see more tests done in the next few days. And, of course, the number of people who are testing positive is going to go up. So those numbers are going to go up rather dramatically in the next few days.
To be clear, Governor, you're talking about 100,000 undiagnosed cases walking around in your state today. You're saying that the state expects that those cases to double every 6 days, but there's only 1,000 testing kits that you know of?
What Dr. Acton tells me, and I rely on the experts, I'm certainly not the expert, but you know, we're going to reach a point in this country, not just in Ohio, where it's not going to be too long when they're not going to have the capacity to test everybody, and we're just going to have to move on from there. Because if you get, you know, 1 million people, 2 million people, obviously you're not going to be testing them at that point. So, look, would we like more testing kits? Yeah, we would, but we're in the same boat everybody else is. We are not unique, but we do have capacity coming online in regard to our hospitals. And so you're going to see the tests that are being done are going to go up dramatically. And when they go up, you're going to see the number of people who test positive go up. But the steps that we took, you know, were informed by the experts who tell us what they anticipate based on the number of tests that we have done, based on the fact that we've now have two community spread individuals who have no idea where they got it. It's all across Ohio, but it's all across other states as well. And so we took this action yesterday. We can't say to get ahead of this, because you can't get ahead of it, really, but to really slow this down as much as we could so that our health, our hospitals and our doctors and our whole health system will be able to deal with what's coming up.
It's a huge challenge, not just in your state, across the country, Governor. We wish you and the residents of Ohio well through all of this. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
A couple of points I want to make here before we move on to any further clips and commentary is that there's been a skepticism that I've noticed that is raised because there has not been enough testing. Then we don't know for sure and don't know the proof. So you have a certain, you know, group of people out here that want proof on everything and without, you know, any entertaining, any speculation, or any, assertion that might be very speculative, see, but founded on, say, previous experience or extrapolating, say, through some model or something. So you have that group out there that's very skeptical about this thing being a real, epidemic or pandemic, see. That's still residing out there in many minds. And so then you have the other side of the coin that, of the medical group that is trying to delay this in a certain way to keep the knowledge of how many people we have infected down so they don't all rush into the hospital and overwhelm our medical facilities. So I think that they're playing a game here of slowly finding out who is, you know, infected and then getting them treatment and getting treatment to the more severe disabled into hospitals and the more mild victims of this, patients of this, putting them at home to recuperate, see. But the ultimate solution to this is always going to be quarantining and separating those out that are infected from those healthy individuals and requiring those. But also, when you get into a community infectiousness dynamic like we've already gotten into, We're late on this. We're really late on getting on top of this. And so as a result, it's gotten into a community infection type of dynamic. So when you get into that kind, then you have to put a 30-day, 45-day, close down the whole society, the whole economies for that long period. Makes people stay at home. That will identify those that are very sick, treat those people, and then don't let them come out of quarantine until they've either gotten over it or they come out feet first, because some of those people will not make it probably. But this thing is much larger in scope. There's debate going on about who started this, where did it start, Wuhan labs. There's this professor that's under charges, possible charges of, lying or perjury to the FBI out of Harvard. He had a secret lab, according to the indictments, in Wuhan, Professor Lieber. I mean, we've got all kinds of differing kinds of intrigue. But we also have something that this came up recently, and someone wrote a book okay? A book of fiction, okay? And that book of fiction had intrigued and centered around the Wuhan lab in certain ways. See, but it was all fiction. It wasn't, you know what I mean? It was fiction. It was a novel. See, but and this novel though had a scenario. In fact, the name of the Dean Koontz, D-E-A-N-K-O-O-N-T-Z. He's written a lot of novels. The title of that is The Eyes of Darkness. And just let me read a little excerpt out of it. Li Shan defected to the United States carrying a diskette record of China's most important and dangerous new biological weapon in a decade. They call the stuff Wuhan 400 because it was developed at their RDNA labs outside the city of Wuhan. And it was the 400th viable strain of man-made microorganism created at that research center. Then it goes on that Wuhan 400 is a perfect weapon, so forth. But this was a book that came out in 1981. I think his revision revised it and started naming it Wuhan later, but maybe not in his original version. See, his original published book. That seems to be what I've been reading. But here we have a book that came out about something like this, not exactly like this, but now they're saying that no one knows the origin of this Boyle, okay? Francis Boyle, who helped put together the biochemical weapons treaty for the UN, okay, was testifying on Alex Jones's InfoWars show recently. He says that North Carolina, the University of North Carolina, was developing this and had this, and they were working with the Chinese and ended up selling this this strain that they're working on to the Chinese. And that would, if you took that and extrapolated that out, then possibly if that did happen, then the Chinese took it and further weapon enhanced it at the Wuhan Institute in Wuhan, China. So that's what one says. Now, how did this actually occur? There are theories out there. And some of the theories are that our deep state actually was behind starting this epidemic, this pandemic. And the goals of the deep state in doing that was to bring China down. They had helped set China up into power, but they were becoming unmanageable and becoming too powerful. And so this one theory is that the deep state was going in there with this to chop China down, chop China down to size. And then also the deep state was going to reset their financial markets, which are in near panic and bankruptcy mode. So that was a one theory that's been proffered around that could have been, some kind of inside, view of what's really going on, see. But this is very, very deep. It's something that you've got to take serious, even though you may be skeptical about what's happened. When it first started, then there were interests that did come in. Perhaps it had nothing to do with starting this, but have taken advantage in one way or another of this unfolding crisis. That started, we know it started in Wuhan, China. So the idea that it came out of a marketplace, though, has been disproven. And some of the first patients in Wuhan had nothing to do with the marketplace. So it's proven now that it went into the marketplace, then it came out of there, but it didn't come out of there to begin with. So, and some of the first victims, then there's rumors of all kinds of people working there at that institute, that level 4 lab. They carried it out. There are three scenarios that I see here, that could have happened. One, the Chinese government released it intentionally. I don't believe that. Number two, it was accidental release, which they have experienced accidental releases from the Wuhan level 4 lab before. And number three is that it was an intentional undercover operation working with some insiders that either surreptitiously placed it on someone leaving there on their clothing or something, and then they contaminated the outside of the lab. Or people that were insiders intentionally were undermining the Chinese government and left with it. So those are sort of the scenarios. And I can't tell you which one is true right now. How do you prove some of this stuff? You can only have, you know, certain opinions and so forth, but it's really, really difficult to prove this stuff out, you know. Okay, so we're going to get on to Giuliani, who was interviewed recently about his proof and stuff he has on Joe Biden and them. And he says he's got the proof. So here we go with that interview.
Former New York City mayor and attorney for the president, Rudy Giuliani. All right, Mayor, do you agree with my assessment of how things shook out?
Oh, sure. Sure I do. I think that Bernie was so frightening, they picked a man that is showing obvious signs of dementia, which is astounding. Because if you consider that what he's displaying gets worse, what's he going to be like 3 years from now?
Yeah.
If he doesn't know what state he's in, he can't figure out who his wife is. And if he thinks 150 million people, which is half the population roughly of America, got killed, then what's he going to be like 2 years from now when that illness gets worse?
Do you think?
I don't think we should put. Look, we're dealing with who's going to be the president of the United States, and we shouldn't pussyfoot around with this. The man has something wrong with him, and it's serious. Not only that, his family has been stealing for 30 years. There are at least 8 cases in which the family made hundreds of thousands and millions off selling his public office. Now, it is possible. It is actually possible that when he said, "I didn't know about it," he's so out of it, he didn't know about it.
That's the best defense he's got.
I don't believe that's true. I mean, the kid has terrible drug problems, and he becomes a multimillionaire. Any father would want to know how, right? And since daddy took him to China to make $1.5 billion of it, you know, I noticed that you said he's soft on China.
Yeah.
If my family got, you know, $1.5 billion investment from China, I don't think I'd be soft on China anyway, but it could affect you.
It could.
When he went to Iraq and he blew the status of forces agreement, and his brother got one third of a $1.5 billion housing project, might have had an effect on it. I don't know.
Yeah. Do you think Biden says that, you know, I didn't know what was going on, when he says that, does that make him look even more out of it? Because that could be the best excuse he has. But when he makes that excuse, because that's the only way he can slide by, it just makes everybody doubt if he has what it takes to run the country, if you don't even know what your family's doing.
If he really doesn't know that his father, his brother and his son were selling him out for 20 years and became multimillionaires, then he belongs somewhere else, not in the White House, and you know where he belongs.
So he's either corrupt or he's incapable of being the president, right? He's either corrupt or he's clueless.
Let me stop the fooling around. I have witnesses that know that he knew.
You do?
Of course he knew. Of course he knew. He knew probably from the beginning, and it's a scam. It's the family, it's the Biden family enterprise. What do they monetize? They monetize his public office. When he's in the Senate, they do it with a real estate company, they do it with a bank, they do it with a private equity fund that goes bankrupt, and one guy in it is running a Ponzi scheme. And they make millions from that. And then they do it with Iraq, and they do it with Ukraine, and they do it with China. And those are the ones where they made millions. There are little ones where they made less, like Romania. This was an ongoing criminal enterprise. It should have been investigated when I first brought it out back in February. And the only reason it's affecting the presidential campaign is because it was covered up back in February by the press, by the Democrats, with the lies that the case had been debunked. I have the case. I have the arrest of the company 3 weeks before the prosecutor was fired. And I have the memo that shows that Hunter Biden was engaged in a $14.6 million money laundering scheme. Prosecutor got that 3 days before he was fired. The prosecutor has been poisoned. There's a record in the Austrian hospital with the foremost doctor in the world who saved Viktor Yushchenko's life. He was poisoned with mercury. Never even covered in the American press.
Well, they don't want to cover it, and if they have to face it, they just call it debunked and they look the other way. Can I play you some video, Mayor, of some unearthed Biden sound from early 70s, I think, 73, Cleveland? He's making some comments that made people think, wow, I haven't heard that before from Joe. Let's listen to him on Black Americans.
I think the two-party system, although my Democratic colleagues don't like me saying this, I think the two-party system is good for the South and good for the good for the black in the South.
All right, and then he follows that up with some comments about women, which some may think was a little sexist. Let's listen to that.
And the only analogy I can really think of is a football analogy, and I apologize to you women in the audience for not being able to think of a more appropriate analogy, but they told me here they didn't want you here anyway. I didn't expect any women to be here.
So say what you want about the content of that, 1973. If that had been Donald Trump on tape saying those exact things, all hell would have broken loose. But if it's Joe Biden, no one cares.
Of course. And if it were Donald Trump and Donald Trump Jr., they'd both be indicted by now.
Right.
So the unfairness of it and the double standard is horrible. But I'll tell you what that displays to me. I mean, I've known Joe since 1976, and I know people went to law school with him. He was the dumbest guy in a law school class. I mean, that could be the product of an inadequate IQ. But right now we got something worse going on. What I see, I mean, I've had relatives who, and I think we probably all have. If you can't figure out what's going on with Joe Biden right now, then you're covering up. And if you can't figure out that he was involved in the bribery, then you're really so naive, you shouldn't be covering anything. I mean, my God, I investigated lots of crimes. This would be one of the easier ones to prove. I mean, knock down easy documents, audio tapes, videotapes, confessions. You don't need anything else.
What do you?
And the cover-up that's going on is so corrupt. It actually is so corrupt. If we don't change it, America doesn't have much of a future in terms of a country that is as fair to Republicans as Democrats or gets politics out of the criminal justice system.
What do you think it says about the Democratic establishment that they will put forward a candidate that's obviously not doing well upstairs and obviously is very corrupt, very crooked with regards to family members getting rich off his name?
And they love that because
what
a lot of them
are. What do you think that's... So they're getting behind this guy. You know, they don't want crazy socialists. I understand the politics of that. But this guy's damaged goods. And they're trying to ride damaged goods to the White House just to get their power back. What does that say about them?
It says about them that they've been completely corrupted by the coverage they get. You know, If someone's not disciplined for doing something wrong, they do it again and again and again and again, at least if that kind of person. Now, Biden and Hillary Clinton don't believe in a million years they're going to get punished for the kinds of crimes they commit in which all of us would go to jail.
You're right.
The press enables them. That's in their mentality. I noticed it when this first came out. Biden said the press has discounted this.
Yeah, right. They're on the same team.
The press discounted.
Right.
Who cares about the press?
Right.
The press discounted the mafia.
Right.
Yeah, okay, Joe. The press discounted it. I mean, that's their mentality. And then he sent out to the press a notice that they shouldn't put me on television. Can you imagine if Trump put out a notice saying they shouldn't put Comey on television? I mean, it is so unfair. And I noticed one thing you said in your monologue. You talked about Mueller. As I think back on it, I think about my encounter with Mueller when I was representing the president, maybe they put him there because they knew he hardly knew where
he was.
It's
the perfect analogy.
Which he demonstrated when he testified.
It's the perfect analogy.
He let the animals run the zoo.
They put a guy up there that had, I guess, some stature, and then everybody else does what they do behind the scenes, and they can get away with it.
Yeah, it worked well for them.
It didn't work perfectly because... You know, no collusion,
no
obstruction. But I think you're going to get the same. They did, but I think at the end of the day, they're going to get the same result as Joe Biden, which is another term for Donald Trump. Rudy, I have to run, so I got to let you go.
Jesse, great show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming in.
They have all this evidence, but there's no indictments. John Solomon, recently interviewed by Lou Dobbs, was talking about maybe all we're going to get is a shaming of these people that did all of these illegal acts with FISA and everything else. But there might possibly be no indictments. Listen to this and see what you think about this.
Award-winning investigative reporter, Fox Business contributor, and very importantly, the editor-in-chief of his new media outlet, JustTheNews.com. John, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Lou.
And you have been very busy this week, as is your practice. You're reporting, confirming that less than 2 weeks into the Trump presidency, and they should have known that Flynn wasn't guilty because they'd already concluded that, and that he wasn't working as an agent of Russia, that the Steele dossier was a fraud and a manufactured bunch of nonsense. And that FBI targets like Carter Page and Papadopoulos made exculpatory statements, and yet here it rolled off.
It's amazing. Between January 7th and January 30th of 2017, President Trump only has served 10 days in office at that point. The entire underpinnings of the Russia collusion case were completely disproven. They knew that the Steele dossier had been disowned by its primary source. They knew that the primary targets they had been monitoring had made statements that undercut the main allegations they were investigating. And then on January 30th, the FBI writes a memo to the Justice Department stating flatly, Mike Flynn is not an agent of Russia. We have to conclude it. Mike Flynn is not an agent of Russia. That was what they were looking at that moment. All of it fell apart, and yet we ended up with another 2 years and 3 months of investigation. It's an outrage when people look at these documents.
And the interview record, the 302s, have disappeared. I mean, can't be found, or at least they won't be found.
Yeah, that's a very suspicious thing. The FBI keeps very good records, except in the case of Mike Flynn's one interview. That should also trouble us all, just like the altered document that they did on Carter Page. Right. The FBI did not act like the FBI here. They acted like a band of criminals in some of the activities they engaged in.
Well, when you look at the Inspector General's report and document 17 outright lies by the FBI, you wonder if this, which is the real FBI.
Yeah, listen, there was a small group of people that hijacked this process, and they did it, I think we will find, ultimately for political purposes. But it's not the FBI old. When you see, I'm going to have a story next week, what senior Justice Department officials were telling Bob Mueller later, and a few months later, after the case kind of fell apart, how concerned they were by the FBI's conduct. I'm going to break that story next week. You will not believe the comments that senior justice officials were saying about the FBI's conduct. Sadly, they didn't stop them, but they knew what was going on was wrong.
You know, I know that you're very much a confident in Attorney General William Barr and John Durham, the U.S. Attorney for Connecticut, who he assigned to investigating the investigators of Spygate.
Yeah.
But here we are, more than a year later.
Yeah.
And there isn't a work product. There isn't a conclusion. That has also been part of what is the new FBI. Truth goes there to die. And reports, and with a report, we wait patiently, and we're told they can't comment because they're carrying out an investigation and haven't filed a report. It looks like a subterfuge, straightforwardly, that allows them not to comment and not to ever deliver the truth.
Yeah, listen, I've done a lot of reporting in this area, and here are the three things I hear. There's been an exhaustive investigation. There are bombshell new revelations that will be coming out, particularly about how early the effort to spy on Trump and maybe other Republicans was. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to see it go back to December of 2015, perhaps. I think there are going to be new revelations. There's going to be new discipline. There's going to be new shaming of the people that oversaw this. I don't think there will be a lot of indictments. There may be some more firings. There may be one or two indictments. But we're going to get some accountability. I do think that John Durham is going to have a nice novel when he's done here. We're going to learn a lot more. And learning and exposing it hopefully will be one incentive to not do it again. But I think people will, if they're looking for a lot of prosecutions, I think they'll be disappointed.
Well, put me down as disappointed, because if you can do what politically corrupt officials of the FBI and Justice Department did and get away with it, the American people have been fundamentally betrayed by also the investigators investigating.
Yeah, a lot
the
of people feel that way.
We're going to come right back, if you don't mind staying with us, through.
Not at all.
I'd like to take up some developments involving our friend and colleague KT McFarland. We'll be right back. Stephen Mnuchin is still in that meeting at the White House. We'll be talking with him shortly. We're back with John Solomon, the editor-in-chief of JustTheNews.com, and we're talking about K.T. McFarland, Deputy National Security Advisor. She says a British intelligence official, she put it, hinted to her that the country had aided the Obama administration, that is the U.K., had aided the Obama administration's early so-called collusion probe, the Russian collusion probe, during the election. Was Obama part of that conspiracy?
Well, it's funny. We're 3.5 years in, and we don't know the answer to that. We don't know what our foreign allies did to assist it. We've been told there's evidence of it, but we don't know what it is. But there's a 5-day window in January of 2017, that same month when the case is falling apart, where two things happen. K.T. McFarland, incoming Deputy National Security Advisor, her co-equal in Britain calls her and says, hey, we're not going to comment on the leak of the Steele dossier. It's the day the Steele dossier came out in BuzzFeed. But you know, he made this incredible comment, which is, you know, it's sometimes hard to tell where British intelligence ends and where American intelligence begins. He was clearly signaling that the two had worked together on the early Trump case. A few days later, Mike Flynn gets a formal letter from the National Security Advisor of Britain telling him, we don't trust Christopher Steele, you should know that. Those are now a matter of public record. The Brits were trying to tell the new president, we might have had our hands dirty on this whole case.
And how many hands were dirty, particularly in the intelligence community, assisting, that is, specifically U.S. intelligence? I mean, the Australian ambassador,
right,
Amit Sood in Italy,
right.
Christopher Steele and MI6 in the U.K. This is a very large coincidence, isn't it?
Well, there'll be no coincidence to it. Somebody set these actions into motion, right?
Absolutely.
And the question is, who was it? And there may be a conglomerate. It may not be just one person. There might have been multiple operations going on, but there was a lot of foreign involvement targeting the Trump and maybe larger, more Republicans than just Trump at the beginning of this whole episode.
And that's why we always, always can't wait for a Monday to watch John Solomon get to work. I appreciate it, John.
Thank you.
Great to have you with us every Friday here. And we appreciate it. Thanks, John Solomon. Up next, Congressman Matt Gaetz on how the president's emergency declaration will help him as a congressman handle the threat of the coronavirus. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Coming up next is this FISA reform. You know, is there going to be really reform on this or not? What I've always thought about was all of these things that were going on in falsely presented to the court. Whatever happened to the court there? Were they involved in this? In this collusion to propagate this thing against Trump? Well, here's a good interview and bringing us to date on the FISA, what's happening in that area about the reforming it. Here we go now. Just a little more information. It's passed the House. It's going over to the Senate. But Rand Paul and others may have some amendments on this FISA reform bill. Some people are saying we should just let it die, let the FISA courts die. But anyway, here's an excellent interview about the problems with it. And it does not protect individuals enough. It allows evidence gathering under the FISA rules, which are much lower, to be used in regular courts later. It's not right. Here we go now.
The House passing a bill to extend the FISA court ahead of this weekend's deadline. The Senate is expected to vote on it on Monday. The bill does include some reforms, but former Acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker says those reforms do not go far enough, and he joins me now. Matt, great to see you. You know, when you think of all the mistakes that the FISA court made in the Russia investigation, signing off on altered FBI documents on the Trump dossier, which of course was never verified by the FBI, and all of this leading to the spying on U.S. citizen, at least one, if not more, a lot of people just say, just get rid of the courts if they've gone that far to accept stuff that is not true. What more have they done that we don't even know about?
Right, and we, you know, everyone needs to remember what Horowitz found as the FISA abuses, and DOJ and the FBI have tried to clean up some of those mistakes, and this bill, I think, goes some distance to address the concerns about civil liberties and individual privacy that should be addressed. And I know that as the Senate takes it up, there's a chance that there could be some amendments offered by Rand Paul and Mike Lee that would not allow the FISA these tools that are necessary to combat terrorism and to combat foreign intelligence agencies. And I think they're important and necessary tools. But at the same time, we can't have them used against a president or an American citizen like they were in 2016. And so I'm going to be very interested as to how this bill is improved in the Senate. And ultimately, they do need to reauthorize these three areas. One is this idea of a lone wolf actor that could be considered an agent of a foreign power when they're sympathetic to somebody like Al-Qaeda, a very important and necessary tool. I think, you know, the roving wiretaps where people are using burner phones to avoid surveillance, I think is another important tool. But again, we have to address some of these abuses. And if we don't, then I just don't think this bill should be reauthorized.
Well, the president himself has indicated that he would veto the House bill as it is now. So you're not alone in objecting to the words now. But from what you're saying, what I'm hearing is you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. That is, there is something about FISA that is worth keeping, despite the awful mistakes that they have made.
Exactly. And we can't stand for those mistakes. And there's been some improvements. I think this new bill is working towards that end. Bill Barr supports the bill as it came out of the House. And, but I think there, again, we need to protect individuals' privacy and American citizens. There needs to be a difference between foreign agents and American citizens. And that's where I think we got into some of the trouble in 2016. So again, I hope that they can improve this bill in the Senate and have it so we don't lose these tools that are still important and necessary and supported by law enforcement, but at the same time address what happened in 2016.
You know, it is interesting that the president and his attorney general differ on this particular bill. The attorney general thinks he should sign it as is, or it is acceptable. Maybe it could be improved. What would you tell Attorney General Barr about what is bad about the House bill? Just in a couple of points.
Well, again, I think there needs to be enhanced protections for American citizens so we don't see what happened to Carter Page and others happen again. And then at the same time, I think the idea that you can collect evidence in a FISA situation, a FISA warrant, and then use that in Article III courts for criminal prosecutions, I think is a very dangerous standard, especially since the FISA thresholds are lower. So again, I know that there are those that are trying to improve this and find that balance where we keep these tools and use them for their proper purpose.
All right, let's see if Mr. Rand Paul can whip it into his shape. Former Acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker, good to see you, Matt. Thank you very much for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you, David. Good to see you.
Well, coming up with some conclusions for this hour, and we're going to be talking a little bit about the coronavirus, okay? The COVID-19 is much more dangerous than people could have ever imagined. It was definitely biowarfare coded and by multiple, you could say, level 4 labs. So it makes it very dangerous. There is one thing that I did discover, or I'm trying to flesh it out. If there's a TB tuberculosis strand in this coating, there is one scientists have put forward that there is a tuberculosis strand that causes the immune system to be defeated. If that's the case, this is an extremely dangerous virus. Now, my listening audience, if you can verify the TB strand, let me know with an email. Otherwise, we broadcast every evening, every Saturday evening, 7 to 9 from Austin, Texas, on thesecrettruth.com, thesecrettruth.com. Now let's move over to China, and we're going to extend our, there seems to be some problems that people have had with China over the last few years. There have been corporations that have not been able to get some of their capital out of China. And so there have been a consensus developing within the corporate community that China is not a good place to do business, that no matter how big the market and so forth, if you can't get your capital out of there, and also there's been only recent changes in requiring less, you know, than controlling interest by the Chinese government. Now, the Chinese government, the Chinese are very, very brilliant people. So they're coming forward with certain ideas that China is completely different than the West, and that their model, the Chinese model, should actually replace the democratic model of the West. Then they're coming on with these government-funded propaganda shows all over the place. You're going to hear that. You're going to hear ideas like the Western schools are pseudoscience and their political science is not quite right on, and China has defeated this, this, and that, and over, you know, over years and centuries that China is still there. But China is a dictatorship. If you go against the government, they're going to go against you and put you in prison, and those prisons are hell to be in. So they're not a nice society at the top. These leaderships are very, very, you say, very brutal and ruthless, and they don't countenance any resistance. And probably during this virus crisis, they begin to identify. They already had a social, network of verifying people with a social network score, you know, like a credit score. They started originating that. And they did that to maintain their power, see. So they're not nice people. They're not going to treat you right. They're far from even the Western democracies as far as having freedom to get in your car and go somewhere. You don't have to get permission. You don't have to, you know, clear your anything with the government that much. You still have to adhere to certain federal laws and things like that. But the life in the United States is much freer. There's a lot more liberty. There's a lot more democracy, even though some of this cheating is going on. We can try to clear some of that up, you know. But anyway, the way I see it now is that these differences in China have built up. And I believe that way back when the West was doing a lot of trade with China in China's favorite, they were losing a lot of sterling silver. So then they started importing opium into China and making a fortune, and they required all payments in gold. These opium dealers did, and the East India Company was doing a lot of this into China. So the British were behind the opium trade, and there were a series of opium wars because of that. After that, that kept China down and from developing into an industrial mighty industrial nation. The second thing I think the West, this is geopolitical things that the West did to subvert their development. The second thing that they gave was communism. With a communistic government, they knew that they would not develop an industrial state, and they didn't. And they had poor output and so forth. And then it's possible now, we can't prove this always, but the third thing that they might have given China was the virus. And this would be because we've seen a break occur between some of the corporate community in China. And Trump has been leading the way to make the Chinese establish a level playing field. The Chinese have been cheating on our trade agreements for decades now. And Trump comes in there and starts making them, you know, treat us fairly, and charging them tariffs and so forth. And they were mad as hell about this. And so, as a result, they're not happy campers, see. And so now we have this virus outbreak that all of a sudden has occurred. And it has been devastating for China to see how they will survive here. And what will happen is conjecture still. But it may result in many of the things that they had a monopoly on, like medicines and so forth. We just can't let them have a monopoly anymore and stuff like that. We've got to tool our manufacturing and our industrialization for key national security products here in this country, or we're going to lose everything. I want to thank each and every one of you for listening tonight. And boy, we've got this crisis underway. So let's get under control and stay at home and do a little bit of quarantining of ourselves. And don't go out. Social distancing is the word. Thank you for listening, and good night, and God bless each and every one of you. Good night.